Well, thank you, Patrick, for that overgenerous introduction. Two things I'd like to say before I start. It's been a great honour to be asked here, and it's particularly good to be asked here to deliver a lecture that's related to the fantastic exhibition that has been organised by Brendan Kane and Tom Heron, which I think has illuminated all sorts of aspects of the Celtic world. And if you hadn't had a chance to look at that, I think you should spend some time looking at it. And secondly, I'd like to dedicate this lecture to Professor Robert Welsh, who was my supervisor and who first suggested that I did some work on Ireland, something that has been perhaps the thing I've enjoyed most. He died earlier this year, and he's someone I shall miss very much, as he was a great guiding light for me. Whether he would have approved of this lecture, I'm not quite sure. Grimalkin and other Shakespearean Celts, anyway. A recent series of teenage fantasy books has swept both of our Anglophone worlds, those starring Grimalkin the Witch Assassin. Wikipedia website explains, Grimalkin is the Malkin Witch Clan's assassin. She is best known for her use of long blades and scissors, which she uses to snip away her enemies' flesh and to steal their thumb bones, which she takes as trophies for herself. Grimalkin was presumably born as a witch within the Malkin clan and was raised up in the dark arts until she decided to sire a child with the fiend so that she would not have to bear seeing or being in his presence at any time. There's also a yacht and a German progressive metal band who share the same name. But here in Joseph Delaney's Wardstone Chronicles, we have a very modern understanding of how family relationships work. And I assume that Grimalkin has now moved on to someone rather more wholesome than the fiend. I'm just glad that my children are no longer teenagers and I won't have to see the film or read them any of bedtime stories. So who was Grimalkin? The Oxford English Dictionary cites Shakespeare as the origin of this frightening supernatural creature, and I'm sure that you're all acquainted with the famous opening of Macbeth, the meeting on the heath, there to meet with Macbeth, I come Grimalkin, Paddock calls, fair is foul and foul is fair, and so on. Notes on the play will tell you that Grimalkin was a cat, a witch's familiar, the name Malkin being a diminutive of Mary, so that the witches appeal to their two familiars, a cat and a toad. That's Paddock. Now, Paddock is a familiar English term for a toad or a frog, dating far back into Middle English and even appearing in the Wycliffe Bible, as the OED again informs us. But the OED is completely wrong about Grimalkin in ways that are all too familiar. Shakespeare, or perhaps Middleton, who may have written these witch scenes, being the go-to witch scene man of the period, took the name from one of the most important and underrated works of 16th century English literature, William Baldwin's Beware the Cat, a work which has a strong claim to be the first novel written in English. It was written in the 1550s, but not published until 1570. But it was a work that had a profound influence on the course of English literature. Baldwin was the literary superstar of the mid-Tudor period, who was also responsible for A Mirror for Magistrates, a work that everyone thinks is dull, but which is about as radical and subversive as anything produced in the period, and another work that, as you all know, played a key role in making Shakespeare into Shakespeare. I'm going to come up with a boast here now. I thought I held a record recently for the quickest ever rejection of a book proposal when I suggested to Oxford University Press some years ago that they have a world's classics edition of A Mirror for Magistrates, and I got a rejection within 10 minutes. One of the more humiliating things about my life recently is I've actually beaten that record, and my record for a rejected book proposal is now 7 minutes. But Beware the Cat is a work of profound paranoia, written at the height of religious change and confusion. Baldwin had become a major literary force at the court of Edward VI, a fiercely Protestant monarch, but after his death, aged 16, in 1553, his committed Catholic sister Mary had become queen and changed things around considerably. Beware the Cat describes a shadowy state whereby the human world is parodied, fed upon, imitated, and closely watched by the cats, who are like us, but not quite, just as they are Catholics, and like us, but not quite, as many of us are Catholics too. You can see the level of paranoia in a work that describes a religious and political situation in which no one was comfortable and no one knew where to turn. Not only did people not know if their neighbours were Catholics or heretics, or whether Catholics and heretics were actually right, really. They did not know if they were actually heretics or Catholics themselves, if that makes any sense. It was certainly like living through the invasion of the body snatchers. Baldwin's narrator in Beware the Cat, Master Streamer, represents the story of the death of Grimalkin, which takes place after a cattle raid, an ancient Irish tradition that had fascinated English observers. A kern, an Irish soldier, and his boy stopped to eat a stolen sheep, their spoil for the day, along with a cow. Here's the quotation, which I'm going to read out. "And while this kern was in the church, he thought it best to dine, for he had eaten little that day. Wherefore he made his boy go gather sticks and strake fire with his fares and make a fire in the church and killed the sheep and after the Irish fashion laid it thereupon and roasted it. But when it was ready and that he thought to eat it, there came in a cat and set her by him and said in Irish, Shain Foel, which is, give me some meat. He amazed at this, gave her the quarter that was in his hand, which immediately she did eat up and asked more till she had consumed all the sheep. And like a cormorant not satisfied therewith, asked still for more. Wherefore they supposed it was the devil, and therefore, thinking it wisdom to please him, killed the cow, which they had stolen. And when they had flayed it, gave the cat a quarter, which she immediately devoured. Then they gave her two other quarters." It's a cat that's, I suspect, even larger than my cat at home, who was recently described by our vet as being extremely food motivated. I think even she would have struggled to have got through all this this gargantuan feast. The story is unsettling. Is Baldwin laughing at the superstitious Irish, or are they uncomfortably close to home? What would others have done when confronted by such an insanely greedy talking animal? Animals in literature, talking animals in this period of literature are almost invariably dubious, rather like the talking black dog in The Witch of Edmonton, which was written in part by Middleton. Some of you may know that. And is this description a recognition that the Irish, even if they did treat a sacred place like a kitchen, that faced similar problems to their confused English counterparts? Is it a way of actually saying that Ireland and England are closer together than you might think they are? Eventually, the cat eats the whole cow, and then the men flee, fearing that they are next on the menu. The cat chases them, but the kern kills her with his dart. But this is not the end of the story. Immediately afterwards, there came to her, i.e. Grimalkin, such a sight of cats that after a long fight with them, his boy was killed and eaten up. So they do manage to eat one of the two men. The kern escapes and tells his wife, at which point his wife's cat, silent until now, exclaims, "Hast thou killed Grimalkin?" And therewithal she plunged in his face and with her teeth took him by the throat, and ere that she could be plucked away, she had strangled him. More significantly, perhaps, and this is the point I really want to make, the news reaches England, and a Staffordshire native riding through Cankwood has his own experience of the effective news network operated by the cats. I'll concentrate, this is the last bit from Beware the Cat, but I think it's important. "A cat, as he thought, leapt out of a bush before him and called him twice or thrice by his name. But because he made none answer nor spake, for he was so afraid that he could not, she spake to him plainly twice or thrice these words following, Commend me unto Titten Tatten and to Puss thy Catten and tell her that Grimalkin is dead. This done, she went her way, and the man went forward about his business. And after that he was returned home, in an evening sitting by the fire with his wife and his household, he told of his adventure in the wood. And when he had told them all the cat's message, his cat, which had hearkened unto the tale, looked upon him sadly, and said at last, And is Grimalkin dead? Then farewell, dame, and therewith went her way, and was never seen after." I hope I've convinced you, if nothing else, that you can see that Shakespeare was not the source of everything, and that the Oxford English Dictionary is certainly misleading, that there's a long story about Grimalkin that lies behind Shakespeare's words in Macbeth. And the first point I'd like to make is about the circulation of news in the British Isles, a new phenomenon in this early period of the printing press and the start of unified transport systems, which were still fairly primitive in this period, and the awful state of roads made it easier to travel by water. Even so, the cats still managed to get their message spread around by different means and make use of humans to do this so that the news of Grimalkin's death gets from southwest Ireland to central England, Cannock Wood. So it's right in the Midlands, and I think it's very deliberate that Baldwin has chosen the idea that this news travels across a long distance as the cats spread this message around. The shadowy state works with great success. What this alternative kingdom of the cats actually is, sometimes it looks like the human world, at others it's quite different, is another matter. Let's return to the opening scene of Macbeth. I suggest that the names of the witches' familiars, Paddock and Grimalkin, were not chosen at random. Paddock is an old English word, Grimalkin one explicitly associated with Ireland, so that they all come together in Scotland. What an audience would hear, assuming that they associated Grimalkin with Ireland, which I think is plausible, is that a shadowy state of witches surrounds, encircles, and undermines the actions of the human world, a message entirely in keeping with the ancient, supernatural, and morally disturbing nature of the play, a world under the sway of spirits like Grimalkin long before her death. Witches are associated in the play with a Celtic twilight world that is unseen until one strays into it, as the Macbeths unfortunately do. What we witness in Scotland is part of a much larger collective entity, and I think that's what Shakespeare's hinting at in this opening scene of Macbeth, that there is this shadowy state that kind of surrounds England, that comes, you know, from Ireland and into Scotland, that this is one of the fears that you have, is that Protestant England will be overwhelmed by these kind of other countries which do things very differently. Indeed, in this period, there was a topical point to make. Macbeth can be seen as a British play, alongside King Lear and Cymbeline, works that, however they do it, are informed by the prospect of a union of the British Isles under a Scottish king. So they're written after James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England and starts to unite the kingdoms of the British Isles. Shakespeare did not write plays like Macbeth, Cymbeline and King Lear in the 1590s, in the first half of his career under Elizabeth. One more reason, I think, why we should not always think of him as an Elizabethan writer, but a Jacobean one too. It's one of the things that irritates me and a lot of other people is that we always think of Shakespeare associated with Elizabeth, but you have to remember that he's just as much associated with James, something that's not that is obvious when you think about it, but it's not always made as imaginatively as it might do. Shakespeare wrote English history plays looking back to the Wars of the Roses and the impact of the deposition of a king, Richard II, works that clearly reflected on the anxiety surrounding the succession crisis under Elizabeth. Looked at from either side of 1603, something I want to develop in the lecture, writers who had no obvious connection with Ireland or Scotland had to think about the relationship between these nations and how they thought about England. So before that point, there's a kind of threatening presence of Ireland and Scotland. After that point, there's a union. And either way, you've got to think about how those countries relate to each other. We have no reason to think that Shakespeare ever went to Ireland, although attempts have been made to make this case, as they have just about everything that could have possibly happened to Shakespeare. In the 1590s, the question was whether a Catholic pincer movement could somehow link resistance to English rule in Ireland, the rebellion of Hugh O'Neill, which developed into the Nine Years' War, with the Scottish Stuart ancestry, the legacy of Mary, Queen of Scots, through her son James VI. That's the fear of that pincer movement, the Scottish succession and the Irish rebellion. But after James had become king of the Four Nations, I'm counting Wales, which had been absorbed into England between 1536 and 1543, rather different questions surfaced. It's at least arguable that The Tempest, which makes no reference to Ireland, has recent events in Ireland in mind at key moments. Here's a bit from The Tempest, it's a famous bit from the second act, where Gonzalo said, "Had I plantation of this isle, my lord, he'd sowed it with nettle seed, or docks or mallows, and were he king on it, what would he do? Scape being drunk for want of wine. In the Commonwealth, I would, by contraries, execute all things, for no kind of traffic would I admit, no name of magistrate." And I'm sure most of you know this bit where he kind of talks through all the things he would do were he king on the island. The words of Gonzalo relate explicitly to Montaigne's essay of the cannibals, John Florio's translation of Montaigne's essays being one of the books that Shakespeare surely owned and made extensive use of. But the use of the word plantation surely refers us to the recent establishment of a plantation in the British Isles, the Ulster Plantation, formally begun in 1611, but started earlier using funding from the livery companies in London to establish the Londonderry Plantation. The idea was to foster a project that united Scots, Irish and English with the same ideal, to civilise Ireland and to make Ulster profitable, a project that bears a striking resemblance to that of the witch's shadowy state in Macbeth, the one seeking to combat what it imagined was the frightening reality of the other. So I'm saying the witches, the shadowy state of the witches is combated by the idea of the Ulster plantation, linking to one seeking to civilise, the other in Shakespeare's work seeking to undermine. Ulster, as I'm sure many of you know, had been the site of the most sustained resistance to English rule after the crushing of the House of Desmond in southwest Ireland in the early 1580s. Ulster was a large forested area that was ideal territory for the guerrilla tactics of O'Neill's forces. Two of the most significant Irish victories and the most embarrassing English defeats had taken place in Ulster, the battles of the Ford of the Biscuits and the Battle of the Yellow Ford. Deforesting and flattening the province and establishing a series of farmers loyal to the crown seemed like good sense and good business to many in England. When The Tempest was produced and written in 1610-1611, plantation was very much on people's minds, as an important forthcoming study from Helen Sonner will demonstrate. Gonzalo wants to start from scratch and establish a golden age, a project that can be related to the desire to plant colonies in the New World, something that plays such as the cynical London city comedy Eastwood Ho had satirised earlier. That was not quite the goal of the Ulster plantation, and no one really thought it would inaugurate a new golden age. But the aim was, nevertheless, to start a new society, something heavily promoted in the words of the king, who was very keen on the idea of plantation, and one of his chief servants, Sir Francis Bacon. So the question is Shakespeare supporting efforts to plant civility in Ireland, or is he satirising them? It's hard to tell. So let's look more widely at the evidence of his perception of Ireland. Ireland does indeed feature in Shakespeare's works at various points, almost always as an incomprehensible land that threatens civilised stability. This is true even of the lightest of comedies, not that any of Shakespeare's comedies are totally devoid of darkness. In the Comedy of Errors, we have a description of Nell the kitchen maid of Adriana, provided by Dromio of Syracuse, who is eager to resist her unwelcome advances. As T.W. Baldwin pointed out long ago in his enormous study of the play, Dromio's description of Nell works well as a disquisition on politics, dealing with events around the year 1590, something that would have been of great interest to the audience at Gray's Inn when the play was first performed on the 28th of December 1594. Dromio provides a rather unflattering description of Nell's body in the form of a blazon, a familiar poetic motif that surveyed a woman's body from her head down to her feet. Blazons could, as this suggests, be quite fruity, in the jargon of my uncle, warning my teenage self about the language I might experience at the Bolton Wanderers versus Bristol City soccer match I was about to attend with my cousin in 1978. He was, in fact, right. The language was very fruity, and I thought some of the players were described in extremely unflattering and unfair terms. So. Dromio suggests that Nell's forehead is her France, England her chin, Spain her hot breath, America her nose, and the Netherlands her nether parts. Antipholus asks, in what part of her body stands Ireland? The answer being, marry, sir, in her buttocks, I found it out by the bogs. The sense is clear enough. We're all adults here and we've been to the bathroom at some point in our lives. Baldwin, rather coyly notes that this is a traditional jibe, and the play's editor T.S. Dorsch suggests that it is probably a quibble with connotations of privy. I love these kind of notes where you can see people getting terribly nervous about whether they're going to offend the reader by mentioning some parts of the body, even though the play's meaning is, I think, very clear, as I'm afraid I'm going to explain. I think the joke has a very specific reference, exactly like the Grimalkin reference, which indicates that Shakespeare was interested in popular lore about Ireland, as were many of his contemporary dramatists. You might think of John Webster's reference to Irish wolves howling in The White Devil. So there's often, what I mean is you often get these kind of scattered popular cultural references to Ireland throughout many of the plays of the period. It doesn't necessarily involve a commitment to something else, but it does show that Ireland was often on people's minds. The reference to bogs very likely recalls a description contained in John Derrick's The Image of Ireland. Derrick's long poem, which depicts the savage nature of the Irish kern, soldiers, and represents the Irish as unnatural and ungrateful subjects of the crown, always eager to rebel, was one of the key works on Ireland published in Elizabethan times, and probably second only to Holinshed's Chronicles, the favourite source of Shakespeare's plays, for providing information for English readers eager to learn about Ireland and the Irish. You can see some of Derrick's woodcuts on display in the exhibition. The text was lavishly illustrated with 12 woodcuts, among the best produced in any English book in the 16th century, many of which have become justly famous. If you lived at this time, it wouldn't just have been in Ireland that you'd have seen these. You'd have seen this if you'd wandered around London. Certainly Baldwin's Beware the Cat has an awful lot of descriptions of heads on display. But certainly it's very notable that the governor rides out, the heads are on the battlements to remind you of the reality of English power in this period. The slide. This is Rory Ogue O'More, the chief rebel who Derrick is describing. He's urging others not to follow his example and so to avoid his sad, lonely fate in the Irish forests with only his fierce dog for company. As you can see, Rory Ogue O'More is saying, "I'm very sorry, I shouldn't have rebelled. It's kind of, it's been a great mistake." And the dog's joining in saying, "Listen, boys and girls, don't rebel. It's not the right way to go." And you get this quite a lot, these people lamenting and complaining about their fate and how they shouldn't have done what they have done and you shouldn't follow their example. And another illustration from John Derrick. And here's some very, very badly behaved Irishmen on a raid burning civilised homes. I'm sure you get the picture of the ways in which Derrick represents Ireland for an English audience. The Irish rebels are alone in the vast Irish forests, now largely chopped down. The English settlers are threatened and attacked by the uncivilised natives who have no idea to live in their own country. This is very much of a piece with most of English representations of Ireland in this period. You get the two things together. The thing about the forests being cut down is also very important, and that's one of the things that the Ulster plantation is supposed to be doing. Part one of the English of the image of Ireland contains a description of Irish eagles, which prefer to nest not in the bounds of English Pale, which is a civil place, but in the Devil's Arse, a peak where rebels most embrace. The English Pale is the area, for those who don't know, is the area around Dublin, which was largely controlled by the English, the rest of Ireland being seen as much less sort of amenable to civilization. So what Derrick's doing in this rather sort of doggerel rhymes is to make an explicit connection between savagery and anality, which is a very, very common enough link in contemporary travel writing. You get these depictions of the body in this period where the head should control the rest of the body, and the more that you're kind of delightful parts of the body control you, the more sort of savage you are. And that's clearly what's on display here, that the Irish are controlled by their nether regions, whereas the English are supposedly controlled by their heads. And a few lines later, Derrick describes the bogs as the natural habitat of the Irish kern. "Yea, though they were in court trained up, and years their lived 10, yet do they look to shaking bogs, scarce proving honest men. And when as they have won the bog, such virtue hath that ground." Ireland, as we know, was full of bogs, notably the Great Bog of Allen. Anyone passing through the Irish Midlands had to navigate, and of which Edmund Spenser complained so bitterly because of the ferocious Irish gnats, as well as the dangers of disease in the damp, unfamiliar climate. Irish sickness killed far more English soldiers than Irish kern. Derrick shows the Irish preferring life in the hostile regions of their country, the peaks and the bogs, both places which are contrasted to the civilised life of the English Pale around Dublin. Gravitation to such areas was in itself an indication of a savage nature resistant to civilisation. It seems highly unlikely to me that there's not some connection between Derrick's poem and Shakespeare's play, direct or indirect. It may well be that Dromio is making a new pun by exploiting the geographical proximity between the arse and the bogs in the image of Ireland, repeating Derrick's joke, or that both are employing a general joke that has become obscure for us. Further evidence is provided in the image of the open-air Irish feast in the image of Ireland. And this is the most frequently reproduced image of Tudor Ireland. So I'll take a bit of time explaining this. Can't, of course, prove that Shakespeare saw this, but it certainly ticks a lot of boxes about the way in which the Irish are represented in this period, which would explain exactly why you get this representation of the young woman as in the kind of unflattering terms that you get in Shakespeare's play. Here we see an open-air feast of the Irish lords, and it shows a number of details which represent Irish behaviour as uncivilised. There's the rather insanitary and unhygienic cooking, which you can see at the front here. You know, this is obviously a fairly primitive way of cooking. There's the mangy dog chewing a bone in the front centre. And also notable is the Irish love of entertainment at such events. We have the bard reciting a poem and the harper accompanying him. But note in particular the two figures on the extreme right of the picture bearing their backsides, I'm afraid, and behaving in an extremely sort of uncouth way at this feast. These, I think, are quite important figures, I'm afraid, which I shall have to explain to you. What the woodcut is making is an explicit link between the consumption of food and the expulsion from the body, again showing how the English represented the Irish as extremely anal in character, having disorderly and uncontrollable bodies, a real sign of a lack of rational purpose, so carefully represented in this period. Think about Prospero and Caliban, for example. So Shakespeare's representation of Nell the kitchen maid is clearly in this tradition of English perceptions of the Irish. But one last caveat. The men are not defecating, as many, including myself, have argued at various points in the past. They are surely, as I learnt recently, farters, a form of entertainment that was popular at Irish feasts, as readers of Alan Fletcher's work on Irish drama will know. It's true. It is true. I'm not making this up, honestly. The overall point is the same, but the detail needs to be noted for the sake of accuracy. And unfortunately, it's one of those moments where probably when you go home and think about what that English bloke was telling you at the lecture, that's the one detail you'll remember. And all the learned stuff that I'm going to tell you about Irish history will kind of, you know, be long forgotten. But it is true, apparently, so you can see there's this moment, the point I think that's being made in the woodcut is that this is the entertainment area, and there's the bard, the harper, and then there's the farters. But it shows the Irish encouraging and celebrating the anus, exactly what Dromio suggested in connecting Nell's backside to Ireland. That's, for those of you who have a nervous disposition, that's the end of that section. Now we've gone to some more wholesome, well, not wholesome, some more violent and horrible history. Ireland posed a direct threat to England in the 1590s, as it had done in earlier periods. One reason why the reference to dark Celtic forces is so powerful in Macbeth. As the Tudors were acutely aware, both Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck, pretenders who both falsely claimed to be Richard, Duke of York, one of Edward IV's sons murdered in the Tower by Richard III, whose body has newly been discovered in a Leicester car park, built up their forces in southwest Ireland, ready to launch invasion forces to England. In Shakespeare's plays, in his history plays of the 1590s, Ireland is where opposition to the English crown develops and grows. It's in Ireland that Richard Duke of York establishes his military challenge to the ineffective rule of Henry VI in Henry VI, Part 2. I won't read all of this. Richard Duke of York is sent to Ireland by Cardinal Beaufort, the Protector, to stem the rebellion of the uncivil kerns of Ireland, who are in arms and temper clay with blood of Englishmen. Yet another reference to the savage and bloody nature of everyday life in Ireland. This idea of the kern, the Irish soldiers standing in for the whole of Ireland, is something that happens very commonly in plays in this period. This turns out to be, sending Richard Duke of York to Ireland turns out to be a very bad idea indeed, as York's soliloquy immediately afterwards demonstrates. York is quite explicit that he has used his connections to and has enlisted Jack Cade to stir up trouble as means to his own assault upon the throne, so that when we see Cade's rebellion in full swing, the pissing conduits running wine and the lettered all facing execution out of class spite, we know that it has an aristocratic origin and is part of a larger plot. Ireland in Henry VI Part 2 provides England with two interrelated rebellions, those of York and Cade, which shall foster civil war as England implodes into furious conflict and slaughter. Or as York puts it, he will stir up a black storm, shall blow 10,000 souls to heaven or hell. Note how he describes John Cade of Ashford. Cade is described by York as bestial, like a sharp-quilled porpentine who can caper upright like a wild Morisco, shaking the bloody darts as he his bells. Cade has actually become like a shag-haired crafty kern, suggesting that his experience in Ireland has made him Irish, or perhaps Hibernioris Hibernis Ipsis, more Irish than the Irish themselves, as critics of English settlers in Ireland often complained, noting that English people in Ireland degenerated and became Irish. There's a picture, again, it's in the fantastic picture in the exhibition, and it's a famous Renaissance image of this phenomenon, that of Sir Thomas Lee, painted by Marcus Gerhardt the Younger in 1594, showing him with a doublet but without breeches, caught between Irish and English values through his service in Ireland. Lee, a military man who made his career in Ireland, incidentally, was executed for treason after the Essex Rebellion in 1601, which further proves the point about the close relationship between soldiering in Ireland and treason in England. So in a way, the career of Sir Thomas Lee follows that of people like the Duke of York and Jack Cade, who build up their power in Ireland and then rebel against the English crown. It's a common theme in Shakespeare. It's something that commonly happens in the period at the same time. York's plan is made clear in his conclusion. From Ireland come I with my strength and reap the harvest which that rascal, i.e. Cade, sowed. So York will return to England as the sower of death. What he does not fully realise is that one of the deaths will be his own, brutally taunted by Queen Margaret with a paper crown and anointed with the blood of his dead son. So York kind of causes more destruction than he realises when he returns from Ireland, having had his rebellion prepared by that of Jack Cade, who has become an Irish kern. In many ways, this play is remarkably prescient of the fate of the Earl of Essex, represented in Henry V. Essex was supposed to bring rebellion back, broach it on his sword, as the chorus to Act V puts it. Instead, he built up his army of soldiers like Lee, and brought back rebellion in a different way, which of course led to his execution. Note also that York refers to Cade as a Morisco, suggesting that his experience in Ireland transforms him into an exotic creature like someone from North Africa. But it also indicates that York regards the Irish as an alien people, useful when they serve his purposes, but disposable and inherently other. Cade might as well be a battle-hardened Morisco as an Irish kern. Either one will do for someone like the Duke of York. It's not clear that Shakespeare sees matters this way. After all, York pays very dearly for his assumptions, and his hazy racism may be a central part of the problem. Richard II is another king who pays for his failure to understand Ireland, and his ill-conceived and ill-fated Irish enterprise enables Bolingbroke to establish the army that will make him Henry IV. Another play in which the plot hinges around a military expedition to Ireland. On Richard's return to his kingdom, where he will lose his crown and his life, he speaks in defiance of the growing power of Bolingbroke, in words that are eloquent, as Richard always is, but which contain a bitter series of ironies. This is a famous section from Richard II, which does again relate the plot explicitly to Ireland. So when this thief, this traitor Bolingbroke, who all this while hath revelled in the night, whilst we were wandering with the Antipodes, shall see us rising in our throne the east, his treasons will sit blushing in his face, not able to endure the sight of day, but self-affrighted tremble at his sin. Not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm off from an anointed king. The breath of worldly men cannot depose the deputy elected by the Lord. A lot of questions one might ask about this speech. Does Richard really think he has been wandering in the Antipodes? Surely not, but the metaphor exposes him as the description of Cade as a Morisco exposes Richard, Duke of York. Richard clearly has a careless regard for a land he ostensibly governs, as English kings were lords of Ireland after the Norman conquest of Ireland, justified by Pope Adrian II's Laudabilita of 1155, which granted Ireland to the English crown and church. By the way, Adrian was the only ever English pope who managed to grant Ireland to England, which has not escaped the attention of many historians. Richard has an insouciant disregard for the realities of people he governs, always a dangerous tendency for a king, especially a Shakespearean king. Think about Lear and his dividing the kingdom up in maps. He doesn't know who he's governing. Here, Richard seems to have no idea who these people are, who he's supposed to be in charge of. Just as he doesn't really care who his Irish subjects are, so does he not care who his English subjects are or what they want. Hence the rolling power of the last four lines of this quotation. It sounds good, but Richard is about to be deposed because it takes rather less than the breath of men and rough seas to separate a king from his crown, as the play demonstrates. Richard, as if we didn't already know, has lost sight of reality. His royal visit to Ireland only serving to undermine him, in large part because he simply does not know who or what he's dealing with. Perhaps we shouldn't be too hard on him. As both of these plays show, kings were damned if they went to Ireland and damned if they sent someone else. Both those stories, you know, if Richard, Duke of York, goes to Ireland and that leads to his rebellion, Richard II goes to Ireland, that leads to him being deposed. Ireland is always seen as a land where the king is most at danger. And this is what this is the way that Shakespeare's plays represent Ireland in the 1590s, as the dangerous kind of other part of English history where English kings are most likely to lose their power. So there was a fear of Ireland very much in the 1590s that reaches a crescendo in 1601, when the Battle of Kinsale, where the Irish and the Spanish forces were defeated, left the English in charge of Ireland. And after that, things looked very different. So the last part of the lecture, I'm going to talk a bit about what things look like after the Battle of Kinsale. It's quite amazing the transformation that happens, where Ireland seems to be amazingly dangerous in about 1600 and effectively neutralised by about 1603. And it's something that we can easily lose sight of if we don't sort of understand that kind of historical reality and see the difference between plays written before and after that point. And again, it's part of, we're confronted with images of Elizabeth as a great queen and have little real understanding of James as a king and the importance that James has, particularly for a writer like Shakespeare. Shakespeare has habitually represented an Elizabethan playwright, even though his career was only half over by the time the old queen died. English perceptions of the world changed dramatically in 1603-4 as James made peace with Spain and the war in Ireland ended dramatically and suddenly. The world looked very different now if you were English, and you could concentrate on moaning about how fat and drunk the king was, how he was effeminate, and although he loved hunting, he was rubbish at it, how he had favourites, and how London was now full of his awful Scottish friends who lived in big houses, talked in incomprehensible ways, and ate and drank unspeakably barbarous things. We may well have lost sight of the fact that when times are not so tough, we find different things to complain about, and so reading evidence ought to take account of this. In other words, people endlessly moan about James, but it's part of the reason they're able to moan about James is because they're safe to moan about such things. Part of the reason they don't moan about the monarch in the 1590s is because they're really scared, and they're not allowed to. So that's one of the things where sometimes people misread, I think, the evidence and get a kind of false sense of what's really going on. James had a great interest in uniting the kingdoms he now ruled, which meant assimilating and civilising Ireland as he saw it. James recognised just how significant Ireland had been when he looked through the collection of state documents in London and exclaimed, "We had more ado with Ireland than all the world besides." As I've already mentioned, his main plan was to establish the Ulster Plantation, which I suspect is referred to in The Tempest. It's this question of civilising that particularly interests me. Drama hardly attracted the same reverence that it was to achieve later, but after the publication of Ben Jonson's folio in 1616, the same year that a folio of James's own works first appeared, as unique an event in the history of monarchy as Jonson's was for a playwright, drama rapidly became a significant element of English cultural identity. And I'm suggesting that those two are intimately linked, that those two kind of publications of folios in 1616. Shakespeare had imported a number of Irish themes into his work to show how fragile and threatened English civilization was, but now his work was exported back to Ireland as part of a civilizing mission. Indeed, it's an odd fact, the first recorded attempt to perform a Shakespeare play in Ireland was on the plantation and in Coleraine. I say attempt as the performance did not actually happen. The idea was to stage a play as an entertainment for visiting commissioners of the plantation to the town in 1628, and the chosen work was Much Ado About Nothing. Unfortunately, as Alan Fletcher points out, the performance was called off because of a song that offended the visiting commissioners, probably a satirical jibe aimed at the London agents who oversaw the colony's finances and who were attempting to remove Sir Thomas Phillips, the head of the colony. Phillips' letter notes that the commissioners took a song that was sung so much to heart that they durst not play the play for fear of offending the commissioners. It seems to be a mystery that we will never really solve, but as Fletcher points out, it does indicate that by the late 1620s, settlers in Ulster were not so entirely preoccupied with their planting as to lose all sense of the value of drama and the performing arts. More specifically, one might conclude that drama was seen to be an important element of its cultural life, in particular Shakespeare, as well as noting the dramatic change in the manner of everyday life in Ireland, which had once been so dangerous and now seemed to be building itself up in a very anglicised way. There were undoubtedly other performances of Shakespeare plays in great households that have remained unrecorded. If an acting company could be raised to stage plays in Coleraine, surely plays could have been staged in Dublin and the Pale in the same period. The first professional theatre was established in Ireland in 1636 near Werburgh Street, Dublin. And I want to conclude this lecture with a few remarks about this establishment. Werburgh, or Warbur Street. Warbur Street was right in the centre of the early modern city, perhaps indicating the significance of the establishment to Dublin and a pointed contrast to the theatre, bear-baiting and pleasure pursuit area on the south bank of the Thames. It's very notable that the theatres in Ireland, and this may of course be accidental or it may have to do with other factors, but the theatres are first established within the walls of the city. They're established south of the Thames in London, so they're much more central in Dublin than they are in London. That may of course be simply to do with safety, it may have some significance. The first master of the revels in Ireland, John Ogilby, took on the role, as Chris Morris has pointed out in his excellent history of the Irish theatre, at a propitious time. The London theatres were closed because of the plague, and the new Dublin theatre was able to secure the services of a major playwright, James Shirley. Shirley, who did not always seem to be that thrilled by his new post, produced a number of important works for the theatre in his brief tenure as resident playwright. His weird and wonderful fantasy about the establishment of Christianity in Ireland, St. Patrick for Ireland, was staged in 1639. With its tactless prologue, wishing that there were at least a few in the audience who knew but the art and labour of a play and could value the muse's plane, the throes and travel of a teeming brain. Obviously, the civilising mission of the theatre was not quite going to plan, and St. Patrick for Ireland certainly pays the audience back in representing St. Patrick as no controversial Catholic icon, but the thoroughly English saint, bringer of civilization to Irish shores, documented by James Usher, in Dina Rankin's words. Perhaps Shirley's plays before St. Patrick had not gone down at all well. What's noticeable about Shirley's other plays written in Ireland is that they are distinctly Shakespearean in style and substance. The Politician, also staged in 1639, is nothing if not a play enthralled to Hamlet. The play is set in Norway, an unusual setting for Shirley. The plot revolves around an unscrupulous politician, Gotharus, who is eager to control the throne through his actions behind the scenes. He persuades his mistress, Marpissa, to marry the king, hoping to place Heraldus, her weak, illegitimate son by a former affair, on the throne. Needless to say, the plot goes horribly wrong and all the villains die, taking a few victims with them, such as poor, silly Heraldus, who dies of a fever after Gotharus gets him horribly drunk. Although the king, realising how wrong he has been about virtually everything, offers to abdicate, his son, Turgesius, supports him and he continues in power. Turgesius prepares for the future by marrying Gotharus' virtuous widow, Albina, and so restoring some sense of order and a proper succession. The play opens, like Hamlet, with reports of a dubious and ill-considered marriage. And I just want to make a couple of points about how much this is a play that is using plot motifs that you get in Shakespeare. So here we have two courtiers who are overheard talking, something that Shakespeare frequently uses. Think about the start of Measure for Measure, for example. So courtier says, "It was a strange and sudden marriage." Hormenus, "Could he not love her for the game?" And so forth. "But he must thus exalt her, no less titled than queen, to satisfy her ambition." You can see that there we hear them, you know, over making this conversation, something that I think is a distinctly Shakespearean motif. Gotharus then enters, muttering to himself, and in the process he reveals to the audience that he has had Turgesius sent away to fight a war in the hope that he will not return, but his plans have been thwarted by an unexpected victory. Gotharis, curse upon his victory. I meant him not this safety when I wrought the king to send him forth to war, but hoped his active spirit would have met some engine to have translated him to another world. He's now upon return. The first exchange, I think, would clearly have reminded readers of the untimely union between Claudius and Gertrude. The second of Claudius's plot to dispatch Hamlet in England at the hands of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There are far more links. Marpessa appears an exaggerated version of who Hamlet thinks his mother is when he confronts her in the closet. She's a woman of relatively easy virtue. The discussion of kingship revisits the issues surrounding elective kingship in Shakespeare's plays as well, which is another interesting facet of Shirley's writing. Was this just Shirley's mode of writing and paying homage to the great master of English theatre? Or was Shirley consciously reproducing these elements specifically for the Irish stage? That, I think, is an interesting question. Either way, Shakespeare is exported to Ireland in the early years of its first theatre, a process that becomes far more apparent with the establishment of the second theatre in Ireland, Smock Alley, in 1662, again overseen by John Ogilby. This was situated at Wood Quay. Like many Restoration theatres, its productions were completely dominated by Shakespeare's plays, and to cite Morash again, King Lear, Macbeth, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, Henry VIII, Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure, Henry IV's Part 1 and 2, and so on, are more or less the staples of the Irish stage for the next century or more. So this theatre, second theatre built up, is entirely Shakespearean in character, making the Irish stage Shakespearean in nature. So we have, first of all, Shakespeare reflects on Ireland, and then we have this exporting of Shakespeare back to Ireland in a way that may or may not be a conscious attempt to stamp English civilization on Ireland. In his play, Mutability, first staged in 1997, Frank McGuinness provided a striking series of links between the rigid hierarchical views of the Irish bards and the major English poet in Elizabethan Ireland, Edmund Spenser. These old-fashioned cultural figures were contrasted to the open-minded playwright William, who is eager to learn about Irish culture. Here is William in conversation with Hugh O'Neill, an Irishman who is also eager to learn something about the English who have invaded his country. It's the last quotation. So this is a quote. This is from Frank McGuinness's 1997 play, Mutability. William, your master has taught you well, Hugh. He did not teach me. I was not unfamiliar with your language. I came from a family that valued learning. I also have much Latin and more Greek. I don't. I know. Speak to me in your language. Sing to me. That's not possible. Sing. Speak to me in your language. You are hearing your own language. When the English destroyed us and our tribe, we made a vow. We had lost power to govern our lives, and part of that curse was the loss we accepted over the government of our tongue. We do not break our vows. I will not sing nor speak to you in Irish, Englishman. Real, albeit fraught, cultural exchange is taking place here, and Shakespeare is learning from the Irish. It's a nice, neat fantasy of reciprocal cultures in action. Whether the reality of Shakespeare's role in the culture and politics of early modern Ireland was exactly like this, I shall leave you all to decide. Thank you very much.